لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه ومن استنى بسنة إلى يوم الدين. All praise is due to Allah, and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. The topic which was presented in the khutbah today was Hajj. But it was Hajj within a particular context. The context of the principle of thanking Allah for His blessings. And this is a principle which has been emphasized in the Quran and in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in a variety of different ways. Allah has blessed us by bringing us into existence, this life, and in the course of our lives we enjoy a variety of different blessings which Allah has given us without our necessarily deserving them. And in reply to that, we are required by God to worship Him. And worship is an expression of thanks for the blessings which Allah has given us. This is why the core prayer in Islam, in our core prayer, the main prayer that we pray in each unit of every compulsory prayer, as well as voluntary prayer, which is done in a formal fashion, we begin by saying, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. All thanks, all praise is due to Allah, Lord of all the worlds. So even in the essence of our prayer, we are guided by Allah to begin our worship, to begin our prayer by thanking Allah for the many blessings which He has given us. And we have many examples from the statements of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, wherein he said, for example, that you should look to those below you and not look to those above you with regards to the materials of this life, because there is always somebody who has less than you. So if you look to those below you who have less than you, then this is better to remind you about the blessings which Allah has given you. If you look always at those above you, then it is easy for you to deny that Allah has given you anything. You will question Allah, why didn't you give me like you gave him? So you become ungrateful instead of being thankful. This is why the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ advised us to look to those below us, so that we would remember the grace and the blessings which Allah has given us. And when you look at all of the various pillars of Islam, the fundamentals which make up the structure of Islam, the declaration of faith is fundamentally a declaration to the community that you have recognized Allah, His mercy on you, and your preparedness to serve Him. The prayer, five times daily prayer, again, you are taking out of your time, taking out of your day, which generally speaking is devoted to providing for your material needs and remembering God, thanking Allah for the blessings He has given you. So your day is organized around the remembrance of God and giving thanks to Him. Fasting. We are giving up food to be able to better appreciate the blessing of food. To remember God and to give thanks to Him. Zakah. Again, we're taking out of our monies, giving it in charity, compulsory charity, to those in need. Giving thanks to Allah for what He has given us. He has blessed us with this wealth. And we show our gratitude to Him by sharing some of that wealth with those who are in need. And Hajj. Hajj, which has with it all of the previous pillars, sacrifices in time, in wealth, psychological, economic, spiritual. It combines everything in that short period. And it is the one major sacrifice that we are required to make once in a lifetime. And the Imam began talking about Hajj and the sacrifices of Hajj by quoting a verse, وَلَتُسْأَلُنَّ يَوْمَئِذٍ عَنِ النَّعِيمِ, that you will be asked on that day, on the day of judgment, about the blessings which Allah gave you. Allah will ask, when we stand before God for judgment, He will ask us about what we did with the blessings which He gave us. Then he went on to point out, as Allah states in the Quran, وَلِلَّهِ عَلَى النَّاسِ حِجُّ الْبَيْتِ مَنْ اسْتَطَاعَ إِلَيْهِ سَبِيلًا, that Allah has prescribed for mankind pilgrimage to the house of Allah, whoever among them is able. And then he quoted from the hadith of Jibreel, wherein Angel Gabriel came to Prophet Muhammad ﷺ and asked him about what Islam was, and he pointed out the pillars of Islam, and in it he mentioned Hajj being the fifth for those who were able. This is all to emphasize to us, to remind us, that this is a compulsory duty on us. And he quoted another hadith found in Sahih Muslim, wherein the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had said to his companions that Allah had made Hajj compulsory for them so they should do it. And one of the companions asked, is it every year? And the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ didn't respond. He asked again, is it every year? Still no answer. And after he asked the third time, is it every year? He responded to him saying that if he had said yes, it would have been become compulsory for them to do it every year, and they wouldn't be able to do so. It is compulsory once in a lifetime. And it is compulsory as soon as one is able. He talked at length about a tendency which has developed amongst Muslims, wherein they delay doing Hajj, putting it off until the latter years of their lives. You know, if you as a young person express to people you're going to make Hajj, they will ask you, why are you going to make Hajj now? Wait until, you know. This is what old people do. You know, when you're just about ready to die, when you've done all the bad things you can do in life, disobeyed Allah as much as you can, and you've run out of energy, now it's time to go and make Hajj. And because Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had said that the Hajj which is accepted, the reward for it is nothing but paradise. And that one who makes a Hajj without, you know, committing any crimes or or treating people badly, etc., such a person will return from his Hajj pure from sin like the day he was born. So on the basis of these statements of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, people have missed the spirit of what was being said, latched on to the text, the words, and concluded that it's best to do Hajj when you're ready to die. No sense using up this wonderful opportunity when you're younger, because then you're liable to come back from Hajj and start doing bad things again. And then there was no value, you know, you've lost the value of the forgiveness or atonement or salvation you got from the early Hajj. But this is a very distorted concept, because what it does is it assumes, one, that you are guaranteed the next year, or the next 10 years, or the next 20 years, or 30 years. And the reality is, no one knows when he's going to die. He can die anytime. He can get sick anytime. Things can happen to him when he will want to make the Hajj that he won't be able to make it. So, it is folly for one to think of Hajj in this light. And if one lives a life of corruption, for one to be able to go and make Hajj, which will be of a standard, which would be acceptable to Allah, it's not likely. I won't say impossible, because, you know, Allah is the greatest, and people can make major changes in their lives. But the reality is that when you're in the habit, when you've lived your life as a corrupt individual, choosing that path deliberately, knowing righteousness and avoiding righteousness and choosing evil, then the latter part of your life, you know, for you to go and make Hajj at that point, thinking now that you can make a Hajj wherein you won't curse anybody, you won't harm anybody, you won't commit any kind of corruption, you will come through with a pure Hajj, the kind of control, self-control that requires, you have not developed. You have been living a life of, you know, total recklessness. You've got no control in your life. So why do you think that at that one instant, for those few days, right, 5 days in your life, you are going to be able now to have the kind of control you never did? It's not likely. In fact, when you go there, and Hajj is a lot of difficulty, even with all the facilities that are now available, making Hajj much easier than it was, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, still, there is difficulty. There are the huge crowds, people are crushed together, somebody will be stepping on your foot, you know, and if you are not, if you don't have any kind of self-control, when a person steps on your foot, you know, your natural reaction is to get angry into. Somebody will be elbowing you in the head, people will be pushing you and you'll be falling down. All these things will be happening to you. And if you don't have a consciousness about what you are doing, that this is for Allah, etc., and have developed self-control by practicing the principles of Islam, the five pillars all along through your life, then you will not be able to handle that. You will not have the kind of mercy which will be able to carry you through that Hajj without reacting to what people are doing to you. And as such, you will not gain the rewards which Allah has promised for those who make an acceptable Hajj. And Hajj has in it, as the Prophet ﷺ stated, that it is compulsory once in a lifetime. It is the major sacrifice that we make once in a lifetime. Of course, we may make Hajj beyond once. However, again, Hajj should not become a matter of prestige. See, because what has happened again to in the Muslim world today, in many places, when a person makes Hajj, he is now called Hajji. You know, he has this title is put on him now as he's a Hajji. And he may wear a cap on his head when he never used to wear a cap before. And he is looked upon in the community in a special light, right? And it becomes an issue of prestige. And people may talk amongst themselves, you know, how many hajjis did you make? So and so said, I made 30 hajjis. I said, I made 40. The other one said, I made, and it becomes an issue of mutual boasting. You know, like how many times have you been to New York? How many times you've been to London, you know, amongst the materialists, right? I mean, it becomes a similar kind of material boasting. And this is not what hajj is. Remember, Prophet Muhammad ﷺ made one hajj. If it was about trying to make hajj every year, you know, so you can put some notches on your belt or whatever, you know, then Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, you know, would have done so. He made one hajj. And what we have to realize is that one hajj that you make, that's the one that counts. You need to make one, which is the compulsory one, and do it to the best of your ability. Following that, you may make voluntary hajjs, you know, and of course there is reward in it also. But the one which was compulsory on you, the very first one you made, that was the one. And the Imam quoted statements of the Prophet Muhammad, you know, wherein he said, for example, that we should hasten to Hajj, for no one knows the time of his death. And in Islam, there is no such thing as an individual who never makes Hajj in his life. Of course, this is for those who had the ability, because there will be people who will not make Hajj in their lifetime. In fact, I would venture to say that the majority of Muslims will not make Hajj in their lifetime. However, the intention, because remember, Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had said that deeds are rewarded according to their intentions. So for a person who is unable, but he has the sincere intention to make Hajj, if the ability comes to him, then of course he is rewarded for that intention. And he, in another narration, advised us that we should hasten to make Hajj, whoever amongst us wishes to make Hajj, because we never know when we may become sick, or our circumstances may change, or we lose the ability because of one need or another need. And he mentioned the case of Umar ibn ibn al-Khattab, the second caliph, you know, who chose to, or decided to, take jizya from those people who had the means to make Hajj and didn't do so. That jizya is a tax imposed on non-Muslims who live within the boundaries of Islam. And this tax which they pay, something like tribute, but what it really is for their defense. They are not obliged, or they are not required to join the army to fight in the defense of the Muslim state. The state provides things for them. They do not pay zakah, which the rest of the Muslims pay, so instead there is a tribute which is taken from them, which may vary in quantity depending on the need and the time. Not as in the case of zakah, the compulsory pillar for Muslims, there is a set amount that is given, whereas in the case of jizya it varies. In any case, when a non-Muslim pays jizya, he's excused from military service. Only Muslims will go to fight. So Omar, Caliph Omar, had decided to take jizya from those Muslims who had the means to make Hajj and didn't make Hajj. He was considering them like the Christians. That's what he was in fact saying. You're like Christians. You're like non-Muslims. If you have the ability to make Hajj and you're not making Hajj. And he was also quoted as saying that those having the ability to make Hajj and not doing so are in fact Christians or Jews. And Ali, the fourth caliph, was also quoted as saying that whoever is able to make Hajj and does not do so will die like that, a death like that of the Christian or a Jew. And the Imam spoke to the community, pointing out that people spend great wealth, large amounts of monies, on their material life and have neglected Hajj in many instances. He then pointed out that in the past, you know, trying to show that there really is no excuse for people, particularly here, to make Hajj, not make Hajj. And the fact that he's speaking about it means there are a number of people here, as surprising as it might seem to us, you know, who have come from distant lands to come and work here. Oftentimes, most people tend to come with the idea in mind that we can make Hajj, first opportunity we'll go and make Hajj, you know. Or a person accepts Islam and, you know, the idea of going to make Hajj is something immediate in their minds. It's close by, you know, before you go back to your country. It may be surprising for us to hear that, but there are many people here who have lived their lives very close to Mecca. You have people even living in Jeddah. Jeddah, you know, 100 kilometers plus away from Mecca, not making Hajj. So he was pointing out that in the past, people, when they went to make Hajj, this was like the journey of a lifetime. Hajj would take years. You had people leaving from West Africa, for example. They would set out, it's a journey, taking years. That's it. When they're going, they made their will, and, you know, because there is no return. Oftentimes, many people who made Hajj didn't come back. Either they died on the way, or they died after making it there, or they just, you know, settled. Went elsewhere. Hajj was the journey of a lifetime. As I said, it took years. As time went on, it shifted down to months, etc. Yet, now, today, it is easy. You get on a plane, it's a matter of a couple of hours from Riyadh. You know, to get into Hajj, come back. Very simple, easy process. So really, there is no excuse for not making Hajj, particularly for those people who are in this area, who have the means. And in the second part of the khutbah, he praised those people who took their children and their women, the people who they are guardians over. You know, a man is guardian over maybe his mother, his father is dead, his sister, she's not married, you know, his daughter, his wife, and these people, these women, according to Islamic law, they are not required to make Hajj unless they have a guardian to accompany them. Hajj is compulsory on them, as it is compulsory on males. However, there is an added principle which goes beyond economic ability, which is that of having a guardian. Because the trip of Hajj is a difficult trip. And a woman can easily be harmed in the course of that trip. So Islam has made it compulsory for her to have with her a guardian to protect her through the course of her journey. So he praised those men who saw this responsibility on their hands and took their families, the women in their families on Hajj. And the children, of course, children, it's not compulsory. A child who is under the age of puberty, it's not compulsory to make Hajj for that child. However, if you take the child for Hajj, then you get the reward of taking the child for Hajj. It is, Allah will reward you for that act. The child, it is no reward in it for that child because the child has not reached the age of puberty. It's not compulsory on the child. So when the child reaches the age of puberty, it then becomes compulsory on that young person whenever they have the economic means to go ahead and do it. But prior to that time, when you take a child, you get the reward for taking that child, getting the child familiar or, you know, to appreciate the blessings and the sacrifices of Hajj. He also mentioned that Aisha, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad Sallam, the third wife, had asked the Prophet Muhammad Sallam if there was jihad for women. And the Prophet Sallam, jihad meaning jihad in the sense of going out and taking up arms, you know, fighting for the defense of Muslim states or for the spread of Islam or whatever. He asked, and she asked that, and he said yes. However, the jihad for them is one which does not involve fighting. It is Hajj and Umrah. So, this is jihad for women. An opportunity for them to gain the kind of rewards that men gain when they go out and fight jihad. They have that opportunity in making Hajj and Umrah. So, it becomes the duty of the males to avail themselves of the opportunities to gain blessings for themselves by taking their women on Hajj. And he mentioned that it's really a shame that there are many mothers here in the kingdom and wives who have grown old and have never made Hajj. So he closed up the khutbah by encouraging people not to delay on the Hajj, and to remember that we have a duty to thank Allah for the blessings that He has given us. The period of Hajj is coming. Those of us who are able should avail ourselves of that opportunity to show our thanks to Allah. Not in just words saying Alhamdulillah, which we should say anyway, with meaning, but by allowing the sincere intention of thanking Allah to be manifest in our actions by sacrificing of our time and our wealth in Hajj to thank Allah and to gain from the spiritual opportunities that exist in Hajj for our self-purification. So that was the basic summary of the khutbah as far as I was able to grasp. If there was anything in the khutbah that I missed of the statements which the Imam made, and he made a lot of statements, you know, I'm trying to write as quickly as I can, but there will be one or two things that will miss me. Was there anything, anybody picked up anything? If there are any comments or questions anybody would like to ask now concerning the concept of thanking Allah for the blessings He has given us and showing that thanks through the various acts of worship, in particular the Hajj, please.
If somebody cannot afford to go for Hajj and somebody else is paying for it, now, let's forget about the one who goes, but that's the receiver of the people who have the money and everything. Can he consider that he has performed Hajj as anybody else?
In terms of what? The reward?
Let's say you cannot afford to go for it. Okay, and I decided, you're a friend of mine, I decided to go to send you for it. Okay, forget about the blessing you may have or not. Does the Hajj count for you?
Yes. I mean, because once the money has been given to you, then it becomes possible for you to make Hajj. You now have the ability, which you didn't have before. So, I mean, the ability doesn't mean it has to be money necessarily that you earn. That's the norm. That it's money you've earned, you've saved, whatever. But it also includes, you know, somebody giving you, granting you that the means, the ability. You know, for example, Rabita, every year in Mecca, this World Muslim League, it brings Muslims from various parts of the world as guests. It provides the means for them to make Hajj. And the Hajj is perfectly valid.
Is it possible to repass in half of the
Hajj on behalf of other people. Yeah, it is possible. The Prophet Muhammad sallam, you know, was asked about it by his companions, you know. But the only thing that he specified is that the person who was making Hajj on behalf of somebody else, do so after having made Hajj for himself. In other words, you cannot go ahead and do Hajj for somebody else if you have not done for yourself. You must do for yourself first. After that, if somebody for some reason is physically unable to come, so he sends the money and asks you to please make Hajj on his behalf, it is possible.
Point about performing Hajj late in life, but the Imam said the spirit of that is no question about it. But brother, there must be a whole lot of Muslims. They finally realize I have not performed Hajj. This could happen to a very large people, particularly in terms of economy and other things. Now, in their case, do you think what the Imam has said about they may not be rewarded as much as they would have been is really true?
Well, I think what you're looking at here again is a means. If a person, the point is that when we are teaching Hajj, how should Hajj be taught? This is really, we're looking at really what is the fundamentals, you know. People learn the five pillars of Islam. But how to do these five pillars? In the correct fashion, according to the spirit of these pillars, according to the guidance which the Prophet Muhammad gave us with regard to these pillars, to a large degree people are not aware of these. They're just taught, you have five pillars, you have this, you have this, you have this, right? And then customs come into play after that. So things are done according to the local customs in the various areas, and not done really in accordance with the Sunnah. So what he's proposing fundamentally is that Hajj, when it is being taught to people, it should be taught in a way that they understand that it is compulsory on them as soon as they're able. It's not just, it is compulsory once in a lifetime, but as soon as you're able. So to break down these misconceptions that people have in terms of customs. Now if a person plans to make Hajj, it's his intention to make Hajj, but he doesn't have the means. He's saving, saving, saving. He doesn't manage to gather sufficient means to do so until he's, you know, in the latter part of his life. Of course, this doesn't apply. Because when he had the means to do so, that's when it became compulsory for him. So if the means didn't come until the latter part of his life, then that's just Allah's destiny. And that he's not included in that category. He's only speaking of those people who are young, who have the means, because they've gotten in business or whatever, they happen to have a good job, whatever, and they have saved sufficient money to do so. It is not a problem for them to do so, but they have chosen to delay it. You know? If they have done it out of ignorance, because of the fact that people around them, you know, all advise them that, you know, Hajj is something you do when you're old, you know, you don't do when you're young, it's foolish to do when you're young, so and so, and he did not have the opportunity to get the kind of knowledge which would make him realize that it is something compulsory immediately when he has the ability, and then it so happens that he carried on through his life with that principle, and at some point, later point in life, he came to the realization that, ah, this is something that I should do, you know, I shouldn't really delay it and delay it, and at that point he decided to do it, and of course Allah is most merciful. That's the time when the knowledge came to him. That's when we are responsible. You know, when we get the truth, when we have knowledge, we are aware of what is required of us, then we become responsible for acting on that knowledge. Well, I think what you're looking at here again is a means. If a person, the point is that when we are teaching Hajj, how should Hajj be taught? This is really, we're looking at really what is the fundamentals, you know. People learn the five pillars of Islam. But how to do these five pillars? In the correct fashion, according to the spirit of these pillars, according to the guidance which the Prophet Muhammad gave us with regard to these pillars, to a large degree people are not aware of these. They're just taught, you have five pillars, you have this, you have this, you have this, right? And then customs come into play after that. So things are done according to the local customs in the various areas, and not done really in accordance with the Sunnah. So what he's proposing fundamentally is that Hajj, when it is being taught to people, it should be taught in a way that they understand that it is compulsory on them as soon as they're able. It's not just, it is compulsory once in a lifetime, but as soon as you're able. So to break down these misconceptions that people have in terms of customs. Now if a person plans to make Hajj, it's his intention to make Hajj, but he doesn't have the means. He's saving, saving, saving. He doesn't manage to gather sufficient means to do so until he's, you know, in the latter part of his life. Of course, this doesn't apply. Because when he had the means to do so, that's when it became compulsory for him. So if the means didn't come until the latter part of his life, then that's just Allah's destiny. And that he is not included in that category. He's only speaking of those people who are young, who have the means, because they've gotten in business or whatever, they happen to have a good job, whatever, and they have saved sufficient money to do so. It's not a problem for them to do so, but they have chosen to delay it. You know? If they have done it out of ignorance, because of the fact that people around them, you know, all advise them that, you know, Hajj is something you do when you're old, you know, you don't do when you're young, it's foolish to do when you're young, so and so, and he did not have the opportunity to get the kind of knowledge which would make him realize that it is something compulsory immediately when he has the ability, and then it so happens that he carried on through his life with that principle, and at some point, later point in life, he came to the realization that, ah, this is something that I should do. You know, I shouldn't really delay it and delay it. And at that point he decided to do it, and of course Allah is most merciful. That's the time when the knowledge came to him. That's when we are responsible. You know, when we get the truth, when we have knowledge, we are aware of what is required of us, then we become responsible for acting on that knowledge. You know?
If he says that, okay, this ayat is not, I am not a Muslim, am I allowed to perform Hajj if I want to? What do I have to do? How do I convince him that no, if it's a Muslim, it's not everything?
Well, Hajj is compulsory on mankind. It is. However, there are different levels of, you know, a thing being compulsory. What is initially compulsory, the primary thing which is compulsory, is belief in Allah. That's primary. If that isn't there, then the other things which are compulsory cannot be done before that. That's like putting, we say, the cart before the horse. And then we have to put the horse in front, which carries the cart. Well, the horse in front here is belief in Allah. That comes first. That is the primary responsibility. After that, then the other things come. So if a person goes to make Hajj, and he has no faith in Allah, then that Hajj is of no value. It's useless. Just as if he fasts, if he gives zakah, etc., and he does not believe in Allah, then it is useless. Because Hajj is an act of worship of Allah. So you have to believe in Allah before you can perform that act of worship. And it be acceptable to Allah. Of course, there are non-Muslims who have gone to Mecca and made Hajj. Yeah. We have, you know, adventurers, you know, who have come out of England and America, you know, because Mecca was considered like, the Kaaba in Mecca was considered like the holy of holies of Muslims, you know, a secret place non-Muslims couldn't enter. So, you know, they had this adventurous kind of thing. They wanted to find out what is going on inside them. So you had some adventurers who left England and America. They pretended to be Muslims, you know, and went with the Muslims and went and made Hajj. And they came back and wrote their stories about their journey and to see the Holy of the Holies, right? So we have people who have done it. But what is the value of that? It's useless. It's of no value in the sight of God. So when Allah refers here and He says that, you know, Allah has made pilgrimage to the Bayt, to the house of Allah, you know, compulsory on mankind. It is compulsory on mankind who have first believed in Allah. Okay? And we have to also again remember that Allah also said in another verse in the Quran that after this year, no mushrik, no pagan will be allowed to come in to Mecca, to Mecca. This is after the conquest of Mecca, you know, because initially, you know, when the Prophet ﷺ made the treaty of Hudaybiyah with the Meccans, they agreed to allow the Muslims to come in to make Hajj, and the pagans would step aside, back out, and then they would go and make their own Hajj, right? Because pagans used to make Hajj also, or Umrah. But after the conquest of Mecca, the verse was revealed, and pagans were prohibited from coming into Mecca. So we don't take a piece of the Quran and then neglect another piece. We have to bring it all together. So that other verse clarifies for us that when Allah spoke of the people, He was talking about the believing people. And also we have, you know, the example of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ in terms of his own practice. You know, what happened in his time. Well, no, it's not repeating the whole thing again. I mean, the question was, if in your first Hajj you didn't have the necessary self-control to stop yourself from reacting to people when they, you know, stepped on your feet or elbowed you or whatever, and you reacted by shouting at them or hitting them back or whatever, right? I mean, what is there a method of atonement for such acts? Or does one have to then repeat his whole Hajj? Well, for such acts, I mean, there's no specific atonement which has been specified where Prophet ﷺ said one who elbows, you know, or one who steps. No, there's nothing of this nature. Of course, when you do it, you realize that you seek Allah's forgiveness for what you've done. It is wrong, right? You ask Allah to forgive you. If you have the consciousness, or you catch yourself after doing the act, asking Allah's forgiveness, etc., you know, then it is possible Allah can forgive you for the act that you did, right? So we realize that, I mean, none of us is perfect. And the Hajj which God rewards us for with paradise is not necessarily a 100% perfect Hajj, because we are human beings. But with sincere intention, seeking Allah's forgiveness for whatever errors we do, trying to apply the principles of the Hajj, you know, to the best of our ability, inshallah, Allah will reward us as He has promised. Our brother's question was, if a Muslim has already performed Hajj and some years later or the next year or whatever, he finds also means to be able to perform Hajj again. Is it better for him to use that money to perform Hajj or to give that money, for example, to the Mujahideen who are fighting in Afghanistan or, you know, some other field which has been praised by Allah? Of course, you know, this is a hard question to say what is better for that individual. No doubt the Prophet ﷺ has spoken very highly of the rewards of those people who support those who are fighting in jihad, you know, helping those who are in need. The rewards for that are tremendous. And it's a hard decision, you know. If the need, to me, I would say, if you ask me personally what I think I would do, I mean, I would say that if there is a circumstance where there is a critical need for funds in terms of some tragedy of, like in Bosnia or jihad in some place, that it would probably be better to give the money in those areas than to go again for one's individual. But then one has to look to see the quality of that initial Hajj. If one had made one which was not satisfactory, then to try to make another one, you know, as a means of correcting for some of the errors that one made on the first one, then that may be primary given that circumstance. But if one felt he made a good Hajj, you know, he felt good coming out of his Hajj, then possibly it may be, you know, better to do so. Hajj again. Okay, our brother just quoting that Sheikh Ibn Baz, the leading scholar of the kingdom, you know, had made the ruling or the fatwa that it is better for a person who has already made Hajj to give that money to the Mujahideen, those who are fighting jihad, because this is something which great rewards have been attached to. However, I would just add that, you know, this is in the case of a person who has made Hajj and feels good about the Hajj he made. But if he went there ignorant and he made a mess of his Hajj, then I would say it is probably better for him to go again to make his Hajj and try to at least make a kind of Hajj that he comes out feeling good about, you know. But given that circumstance, then it is better, inshallah, as our eminent Shaykh Ibn Baz has ruled, to give for the jihad or some other major need in the ummah. Well, the scholars have held, you know, majority of scholars have held that Hajj is not required of her. She does not have the means. By not having a mahram, she doesn't have the means. Her means are not complete. There is a minority, you know, of scholars in recent times who have ruled that if she travels with a group of women, you know, that this is acceptable. However, you know, I would tend to think that since the mahram has already been made a requirement for her, the fact that she has the remainder of the means, but not this means, but she has the intention to do so, Allah is rewarding her for that intention already. So now, if Allah has not required of her to go until she has this added means, for her to now go when it is not a requirement is to put herself, you know, in a circumstance which Allah has not asked of her. You know, Allah is most merciful. He is already, you know, blessing her for having the intention and saving the means, but just not the means being complete. So then why go and put yourself in a circumstance which is really of a questionable nature at best? So I would, support the view that, you know, the scholars, that a woman who has not the means should not do so. Because this is an actual part of her means. Just like a person who hasn't got the economic means, people will ask also, can I beg my way to Hajj? No. Islam doesn't really, you know. You don't have the economic means, you have the intention, it's good enough. But to go begging from town to town, you know, some people did this. They would go, they'd leave their area and just by begging on the way, make it to Hajj, to make begging through Hajj and begging on the way back again. You know, huh?
A lot of people
Quite possibly, you know. My brother just suggested that a lot of people who set out in that fashion didn't make it, you know.
My information came from some years ago. I had a travel agency in the States, and I applied to Thomas Cook Travel Agency, which at one time was the largest travel agency in the world, for information on, you know, establishing my agency. And they sent me a book called The Great Journey, and it was the story of Thomas Cook and how they started. And one of the chapters was dealing with one of the ways that they were able to help the British government to gain influence in the Muslim world was through, at one time, I think it was in India, as I recall, about 10 years ago. There were a lot of Muslims who had gotten stranded in India, or a certain place in India, like a seaport. They'd been stranded there for years. And there'd been a lot of trouble with piracy and with many other situations. And it had gone on for a very long period of time. And Thomas Cook spoke to the government of India, and they offered to transport these Muslims free to an area where they were, you know, continue on some time. And they were talking about how there were different towns and whatnot that had started by people who had started out begging their way to houses. That's very specific, very interesting, but only available through travel agents.
Well, brother, you know, it is the Wami, you know, collected over 12 million riyals in a couple of weeks, in less than, you know, in a very short space of time to get money, to get food and supplies there. You know, there have been collections made, there have been major collections made, huge amounts of money have been gathered. But the problem is that they cannot even get those supplies into Bosnia. They're held up. This was also part of the report. So, you know, it is not a question even of of course the money should be given, and monies have been given, monies have been collected, but they are being stopped from being able, they cannot get from Croatia into Bosnia to get the supplies to the people. The thing has been cut off. What this requires is military intervention. This is what is really required at this point in time. But unfortunately the Muslim Ummah is so scattered and torn apart that there is no cohesive means of actually dealing militarily, because that's what they should do, is to send, as they were, you know, prepared, you know, in the past, to send armies, etc., you know, on other issues. They should be prepared to send armies now to stop the Serbs.
The UN has pulled out, as it goes, one of the representatives shot there. Okay, so now there's no UN mediation or arbitration, you know, so
it's not a question of just the food and that, as I said. The food supplies and that have been gathered, but they can't get it to them. It needs military. It has to, because the Yugoslav the Federal Army is supporting the Serbs in their, you know, massacre of the Muslims. Pardon? Yeah, this is the New World Order. Yes. It's not a question even so much of pressure on Bush, you know. I mean, they have the means to intervene. Of course it would mean, I mean, it would be a heavy political move, but this is really all that remains. To try to put pressure, this is a long way around. To put pressure on America to intervene on their behalf. I mean, the Turks were right there, you know, who were supposed to be concerned about the new Muslim states that are being freed. I mean, they're the closest. Actually, many of the people in Bosnia will be massacred are of Turkish origin. So if the, you know, if their own, you know, countrymen are virtually, in a sense, though I can't say all of them are that case, but many were of Turkish origin, you know, and then they're sitting there. I don't know what they're doing. How they can't move.
Observation. When the Soviet Union dissolved, everybody amongst the Muslims, at least most of us, were very happy. It was a great thing. And in a way it was. But one of the things that I observed is immediately there was some paperwork distributed, and I forget the organization, of collecting money to build mosques in those places, Bosnia, Azerbaijan, and incidentally there have been more Muslims killed in the Azerbaijan area than there have been in Bosnia. I understand that maybe 2,000 or 3,000 Muslims have been killed in Bosnia. They say over 15,000 have been killed in Azerbaijan, and that's right on the coast of Turkey, right on the border. In Turkey, I read in today's paper, it says they will not intervene. But anyway, I think that what we're looking at, and this is only my personal opinion, what we're looking at is a response to Muslims gearing up to help Muslims in another area to begin practicing Islam and to begin doing dawah in that area to strengthen yourself Islamically. I think that someone got a hold of one in Zayat, took it over there, and because this situation that's going on is, you know, like everybody's talking amongst the European, amongst the Christian nations, how they're abhorred by it. It's terrible. It's against international standards. It's against this. It's against that. So forth and so on. But none of them are making any definite moves to stop it. And I personally don't expect them to, because the history of Christians is that they have killed Muslims. That's the history.
right from the first crusade to this time. When they first went into Jerusalem, they went in, they just started massacring people. There was no one there expecting them to get their house. And they killed people all the way, from the time they left Europe to the time they reached Jerusalem. The response that came eventually pushed them back. It was just that. It was a response or a reaction. But this is the basic history. This is what I've seen in 1400 years of Islam and this interaction with Christianity. And I don't see that much difference in the time period. So, but the observation is that this is really the response to a potential helping hand being given by Muslims to those Muslims in that area for the purpose of making them stronger in this land. My personal opinion.
Okay, if there are no more comments or questions, we'll close up. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa ant. Astaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk. We ask Allah to help those of us who are able to make Hajj and have not yet done so, to act on the advice of the Imam, on the commandments of the Quran and the Sunnah, and to do so. And we also ask, you know, Allah to give us the courage to act in whatever capacity we have to aid Muslims who are under oppression in various parts of the world. And finally, I ask Allah to help us to be conscious of Him and our duty to Him throughout our lives, and that we die as Muslims. Amen.